Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Award-winning writer Kevin Berry's latest, The Heart in Winter, is a funny and beautiful tale set in the Wild West, as well as his first novel in 5 years and his first ever to be set in America. It's a project he's been contemplating for more than 20 years following a research trip to Montana in 1999. The Heart in Winter is a big-hearted, violent, hypnotic, and lovelorn epic set against the iconic genre of the American Western, featuring an unforgettable female protagonist and tackling the dislocation and self-invention of the Irish immigrant experience. Booker Prize long-listed and international Dublin literary award-winning novelist and New Yorker published short story writer Kevin Berry is the author of acclaimed novels including Night Boat to Tangier, Beetlebone, That Old Country Music, and many others. His latest is The Heart in Winter, a novel, and we welcome Kevin Berry. Kevin, what a delight. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me. It's great fun to talk to you.
It's a great honor for me to have you on the program. I am curious, as I mentioned in the introduction, the roots of this go back some two decades. What, I guess the easy question is, what took you so long? But the more intelligent question would be, what brought you to the place at that time and then to hone this to what you wanted it to be?
Yeah, well, I guess we have to go back in time a quarter of a century to 1999. And in the summer of 1999, I was 29 years old and I had one of those classic 29-year-old chats with myself. I said, young man, it's time to attend to your prose. Write that novel, you know. I was working as a freelance journalist at the time in Cork City in Ireland. And I said, OK, I'm going to write a lot of articles, save money, and I'm going to have 3 months to make a start on a novel. And I bought a little caravan and put it on a beach in County Cork out on the coast. And I had nothing. I had no idea what I was going to write a novel about. And I started to go for these walks in the mountains. And I came across some old abandoned copper mines. I went, okay, wow. And I started to research them a little bit. And I discovered that in the 1880s, the mines had played out in County Cork. And all the miners had moved to Butte, Montana. And I thought, wow, this is a Western, but it's got County Cork accents. I'm in. This is the Western I've been waiting for. And I thought, okay, all I need to do now is get to Butte, Montana.
So you go to Butte, Montana, and is that research to say this is, let me see what happened here then and what's happening here now?
Yeah. So I flew to Seattle and I got on a Greyhound bus for like 15 and a half hours or something crazy and landed up in Butte. And like the city is still very proud of its Irish heritage. So when you show up with an actual Irish accent, with a brogue, you get embraced to the heart of the city very quickly. And the people were really kind to me. I was telling everybody I was writing this novel about the migrant experience here and what have you got for me? And I got loads of great stuff, great research material. I got letters that Irish miners had written back in the 1890s. I had all this fantastic material about the bars and the brothels and the opium parlors and all this. I knew I had a great world for a novel. So I went back to Cork City and I wrote 120,000 words and it was all dead on the page. There was no real characters. That was my problem, you know. The people for this story hadn't appeared to me yet. And I kind of slowly, sadly pushed it to one side and eventually I got it together to write 6 other books. And 22 years passed by and I was walking in the woods one day. It was kind of late in the pandemic near where I live now in County Sligo in Ireland. And I thought, you know what? If you're in the woods, you're in a Western. All you need is an imagination. And I kind of saw them then. I had a vision in my mind's eye of a young couple riding double on a horse. And I thought, okay, if they're riding double, they're in trouble. They're trying to get away from someplace. What if it's Butte, Montana in 1891? And I finally had it. I finally thought, this is actually a really contained story. This is a story of runaway lovers. And I have that whole background in my mind already of that place then, that world. And I kind of had a ball for the next 10 months writing this. As soon as I had these two characters, Tom and Polly, runaway lovers, they just kind of galloped down the road with this story for me. And it was just kind of hanging on for the ride.
So you didn't have to even go back to Butte, Montana, because you already had the background.
And I thought maybe I should. As I started to write, I thought, okay, let's go back to Butte now. And travel restrictions had just lifted after the pandemic and all of that. But I thought, you know what? No, I have all that stuff. It's there. And that even the research, because I had done it so long previously, it had a kind of a nice elegiacal quality for me. I kind of really had that stuff in my bones. I felt all that old material about the old Butte. And I think it was the right decision not to go back, just to trust the research that I had from all those years before. And a Western actually is, it has to be said, as a genre, as a form, it's great fun to write. And it gives the writer a lot. It naturally offers momentum and plot, because in Westerns, people are always jumping up on horses and lighting out for the territory. And you just have to go with them.
You said a moment ago that this was a very contained novel. Is that a good way for a novel to be?
Yeah, if you can keep a central thread of the narrative to mind as you're writing it, it's a great help. And this is often what you can't do in an earlier part of a writing career. Like when I was trying to write this when I was 29, I thought this has to be an epic. You know, I have to do everything about Butte, Montana. I have to do the mines and the police and the politics and the migration over there and bring in a love story. But then I thought, no, you can just reduce it all down. And often what happens early in your writing career is that ambition and ability aren't quite in balance. You know, often you're trying to write novels that you're years or maybe even decades away from being able to do it yet. And a lot of it is about, sounds kind of weird, but it's about trying to make your research disappear on the page. It's trying to cut it down, you know, like if you read great historical fiction, if you go back to somebody like, say, Hilary Mantel and those great novels like Wolf Hall, she wrote about Thomas Cromwell. You can't see the research on the page. It's all there, but it's submerged somehow beneath the story and it's given weight to the story. But it's all in those writing chops about how to just keep it to the sides, you know, to make your world believable, but don't let the research take over this kind of story.
As you described, you have the 25 years ago as you're writing the story and it is lying there on the page and not alive at all to your way of thinking. So it seems as though there had to have been for you a maturation as a writer that brought you to a point where you said, okay, now I possess the skills that I can do this.
Yeah. And it's kind of like it's my seventh book in total now. There have been four novels and three story collections. And it's enough of time I can see myself change as a writer over that period of time. I think early on, I was very interested in language and style and kind of atmosphere in the page and what I could do with those. And I'm still very interested in and devoted to those elements. But more than anything now, I'm thinking about the people. I'm thinking about the characters and I'm really kind of living with them. You know, for the 10 or 12 months I was writing this novel, I was with these two, with Tom and Polly all the time. And I really missed them, you know, when I finished the book. Character now is the most important thing for me, to really get a feel for them, to really, obviously, to be able to hear them. You have to be able to hear what they're saying, how they express themselves. But weirdly enough, what I often think about first when characters come to mind, I try to think about how they hold themselves physically in the world. How they arrange themselves physically. How does he hold his shoulders? How does she use her hands? If you can get these kind of gestures in your mind, you get so much about that person and about that character, you know? Very often I'm writing about Irishmen from working class backgrounds, which is my own kind of background. And if you look at that character, very often his physical hold of himself in the world is very tense. You know, there's a lot of tension in it and the shoulders are kind of squared in a defensive kind of a way. And in that stance, there are hundreds of years of religion and class and politics and all of these things feeding into it. But it's a really, if anyone listening out there is trying to write themselves in any way, trying to tell a story, before you even think about what they're saying, think about how your characters are holding themselves and think about how they're facing into the world, you know, because once you get that, you get so much more.
Kevin Berry is the author of The Heart in Winter, a novel that is published by Doubleday. So you have these two characters, as you mentioned, Tom Rourke and Polly Gillespie. And once you find those characters, then you start to experiment. You start to work with them to see ultimately what works, to see ultimately how you turn the lock and key to see where everything starts to fit.
Yeah, I guess one thing that you get, Joe, as well as from experience writing fiction, is you get a little bit more economical with your time. So when I had this idea of Tom and Polly, I said, okay, I'm going to give him a week and I'm going to give her a week. I'm going to write two chapters and see how it feels. And that first week I sat down and wrote about this 29-year-old Irish man in Butte in 1891. And he's a disaster of a young man. You know, he's a doper, drinker. He's getting into trouble all the time. He has lots of little jobs, no real jobs. He's a kind of a poet. And he's a young man of literary ambition, you know, and I know what that feels like. And I thought, okay. And it felt promising as I started to write him. I felt like I was naturally getting the kind of world building into the story as I gave his view as he lurched around town on this epic pub crawl at the start of the book. My second week working on it, I said, okay, I was a little bit more nervous because Polly is an American voice. She's a young lady who's just landed in Butte from Chicago to marry an older mine captain, a very religious, devout man. And inside about 10 minutes that morning writing Polly, I said to myself with some glee, I have a novel. She was just there. She was ready to go, you know? And that's the trick of it with fiction. It's very mysterious, but sometimes you just have, what you're looking for always is the story that's ready to go, the story that you have, the voice, it's there for it. And as soon as I started to write out that, yeah, I know what she sounds like. And she immediately felt very sure of herself. She felt like she knew exactly who she was in the world and she was comfortable in her own skin. Tom is none of these things. He's searching for an identity. He's trying on all these airs. Is he an outlaw? Is he a poet? What is he? Whereas Polly is completely kind of completely aware of who she is. And she kind of knows she's going to be fine. And she's the kind of, I think she's the calm center of the book and it needs a calm center. And there was no way it was going to be Tom. You know, but I think they work as a pair. You kind of buy them as a pair because in that horrible modern phrase, they kind of complete each other and they're very interested in how they look.
It's also interesting because there are moments where Polly is such an incredible character and a beautiful character that because of Tom and his Irishness that they blend together so well. So I at least had to remind myself at times that Polly was American.
Yeah, that sounds good to me and a good thing. She felt very natural in the voice. Like I would have to say she is extremely influenced by my cinema going and my film watching in terms of particular influences. I love those 1970s American revisionist Westerns, things like McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And the Missouri Breaks and movies like that. But I especially love those Terrence Malick films, Badlands and Days of Heaven. And in both of those, he uses a female voiceover that kind of knit the story together. Sissy Spacek does it in Badlands and the late Linda Mance beautifully does it in Days of Heaven. And those two voiceovers give me a lot of the note for Polly's voice as well, I think. I could just kind of use it like a tuning fork, you know? I even wrote down bits of dialogue from the voiceover in Days of Heaven and pinned it above my desk. And if ever I was struggling with Polly, I went, there it is. That's her note. You know, that's the rhythm of her voice. And she's kind of spacey. She's kind of a space cadet. She is very sure of herself, but she's always kind of off the beat of the images that we're seeing on the page. She's just kind of slant kind of view on things. And yeah, it was great fun to write her.
You've told me in the past that you see yourself as a comic writer fundamentally, and that seems to be certainly the case here. I mean, this book rings you out pretty good, but there is that style, that punch to it.
Yeah, I mean, my tactic always, and like some writers will tell you, they never think about the reader very much. I do. I think about the reader a lot, and in quite a kind of pugilistic spirit. I'm trying to think, how am I going to tear him apart here? How am I going to make this a really intense and emotional experience? And my usual tactic is comedy. I think if you can make the reader laugh, a laugh is an emotional response. It's a physical response. And they're opening up with every little chuckle that you get out of the reader as they read through your story. They're opening up all the time and they're opening themselves to your manipulations. You can slip in with the sadder material, the heavier stuff, the more emotional stuff. It's a Western, so there is violence in the book, but very quickly, it seemed to be my tactic to keep the violence more or less off screen. It's reported on rather than seen in gory close-up because I felt like that fundamentally, this is a love story and I didn't want to break the romantic kind of spell of the book. And I felt to have moments of extreme violence close up would do that. But you have to be true to the genre as well. And there are young people in a lot of trouble and in potentially violent trouble. So you can't avoid it completely.
And it seems that you chose to go for not just one bad guy or one villain, but several.
There are a trio of Cornish gunsmen who take off quickly in pursuit of our runaway lovers. The Cornish and the Irish never got on very well in Bute, according to the historical record. As you read through the old material there, the Cornish were considered tough, really tough breed of mining men, and there was often trouble in the bars between the Cornish and the Irish. And the Cornish got a name for being gunsmen at times in the West as well. So it was fun to go with three large Cornish gunsmen as a posse. You got to have a posse. It's a Western. Mm. To go with it, you got to get a posse out there at some point.
Kevin Berry is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is The Heart in Winter. I have to say that one of my favorite parts of this novel is the profanity. I just am in awe of how you use it to such brilliance. I'm curious as to how conscious you are at the time of writing of that. And because it scorches every time you read it, so it's not there too much, but when it's there, and it's just great.
I think it has profanity if you're going to use it, and I do quite a bit in my books. It has to, there has to be a justification for it. So I'm thinking as I write this, I'm writing about Irish copper miners in a saloon in Butte, Montana in 1891. They're not going to be speaking drawing room English. You know, it's going to be rough enough talk. I didn't think about this novel very much in the intervening years between abandoning it and coming back to it. But I do remember when the glorious television show Deadwood began about 2006 with its marvelously profane dialogue, seeing it and immediately loving it and thinking, gosh, that's how I could have done my Butte, Montana Western. But I mean, the thing about swearing and Irish people, there's a couple of things. One is we're really good at it. You know,
oh, so good.
We just have a knack for it. I'm reliably informed we're second best in the world at swearing, that nobody is better than the Mexicans. I don't know how true this is. The other thing about profanity that makes it really interesting, I think, is what it is. It's a defensive use of language. It's characters putting up a shield. They're protecting themselves with this vile talk. You know, and they're using it poetically as a kind of a display as well. And it's really interesting to ask why characters feel the need to do that. But I must say Deadwood, again, was a big influence. And David Milch, the great creator of that show, who wrote a lot of the episodes, used a fantastic register for the show. He used this kind of almost Shakespearean, Elizabethan register for the dialogue in the show. And it's not like people were actually speaking like that in North Dakota when the show is set in the 1870s, but it feels right, you know, and that's all you have to do as a writer. If it feels right for the time and place, you can get away with it.
Absolutely. It also is, I think, there's a beauty to that language as well. What I found fascinating is that you will use it in the dialogue, but you also use it extensively in the narration, which is great.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's like a condiment, you know? If you have some really nice sea salt, you know, and you're making your spaghetti at yeah. home, what does this need? Maybe some chili flakes, you know, just a pinch of good chili flakes, just to give it a little bit of bite. I would have to say I grew up in a pretty profane household, in a pretty profane community, in a pretty profane working class Irish city called Limerick. So it's our natural mode of communication. There can be issues sometimes. I've had people at readings, the C word is troublesome. It has different meanings on either side of the Atlantic. In Ireland, it's almost used as a term of endearment. But that's just us. But yeah, it's profanity as a topic, I think, is interesting.
I recently interviewed Brian Cox of Succession fame, and he was talking about how the Scottish are so good, as his character in Succession is, at saying the F word. And yet he said, but nobody has the Irish beat on saying the C word.
Yeah. And it's like, you will happily call your friend a seabird in Ireland, and it's taken well, and it's taken a warm-hearted spirit. It's not gendered in the way that it is in the US when it's used on this side of the pond. So there is a kind of a fundamental difference there. But yeah, I think of swearing again and profanity and these words that are considered taboo. And I think, you know, usually they're just terms for parts of the human anatomy. And it's kind of mysterious why they have taken on this kind of sense of taboo.
And Polly just fits in with all of that. And because, as you said, this Western tableau fits perfectly with that as well.
I wanted the novel to feel like very much in the present moment and the momentum kind of opening up. But we do sense that this is a young lady with a little bit of a past, that she has been in difficult situations previously back in the East. When she was living back there, but she turns out to be quite a natural for the West, I think. And it was you know, this whole thing of young women moving out there to marry guys in Butte, Montana, this happened. These girls would get on the train on the basis of a few letters and go out and marry some guy literally off the train. And it was kind of, the deal was, you know, come out here and join me and you'll have a house. The miners in Butte were making great money for the time. They were making $7 and $8 a day, and this was great money in 1891. So they were just about, they had the wherewithal to tempt women over to set up a new life. Very often they were writing to Irish girls who were working in like domestic service in New York or Boston and Chicago and saying, well, come out here and you'll have a house. You'll get a house. We'll get married. Right. And they tried it. They risked it. Brave, brave women.
What is it about Tom, of being a poet and also this ballad maker, of having the draw to both drink and dope, that is so sadly is such a part of an artistic life?
Yeah, he's got this whole great kind of need to express in some way. He's trying on these versions of himself, and he is so uncertain in his own skin. Again, I wanted the momentum to be forward moving in the book, so we don't go into Tom's past very much, but we sense again that it's not good, what the circumstances that he's come from in Ireland. But I like to think of him as not quite a despairing character either. He knows some great event in his life coming. He knows there's some magic coming that's going to make everything for a while, at least, worthwhile to him. And for sure, he's a mess and he's dissolute. But he's got some kind of spark or fire in him as well, I think. And I think Polly responds to this when they meet.
How much did you want to? How much did you know about the background of these characters, was shared or not, going into the writing of them?
Yeah, I kind of was getting hints, I think, and it's a good question. I was kind of getting hints of what they'd come from, but I was very determined not to go back into it too much. I wanted this novel to move forwards. It's possibly because my previous novel, Nightboat to Tangier, really moves backwards all the time and goes into the events that led the characters in that book to where they are. As that story opens, and I wanted this one to have a kind of a momentum in kind of respect of the genre, you know. That's why we love Westerns, for the pace and the plot and the momentum of them.
That is a propulsion that is seems unrivaled. It's a wonderful novel in that respect. Well, in so many respects, but especially in the pacing of it. I was told one time by a mystery writer about how sex scenes can screw up that how easily they can screw up that pacing, that speed.
Yeah.
But you seem to handle that brilliantly.
Love is difficult to write about. You're immediately, as a writer, on swampy ground when you're writing about love. You can fall into the goo very easily, and you can go into a lachrymose place where it just becomes a mess. So the love has to be real, and the lovers have to be right for each other. And I think there is the sense that makes the novel work. And it's when Polly and Tom meet each other, they realize at once, this is it. This is a thunderbolt. This is the magic in our lives. We just have to follow this thing wherever it's going to take us. We have no choice. And they go with that.
And we go with that too, right? That brings us, once you're on that horse, we're on it too.
We're all on the horse with them. We're all on the Palomino as it heads for Pocatello Junction.
So, in other words, the best thing that we can say about Kevin Berry and his writing is that he didn't fall into the goo.
I'll take it. I'll absolutely take it.
The other thing I just want to say about this, though, is that how you can do that, of all of the things that we talked about, of all the ingredients of a novel, that you do that with such clarity and beauty is just astonishing.
Yeah, it's kind of I like the sense of this romance being the great event of their lives. You know, I love that about the story. And it's also, it's a hard life, the Rocky Mountains, 1890s, tough life. And you have to kind of, you have to make your fun where you can find it, you know. And the Italians have a great old saying. The Italians say that sex is the poor man's opera. You know, love and sex and attraction and that sense of falling in love. That's the great drama of our lives often. And Tom and Polly are very aware of this.
The name of the new novel, The Heart in Winter. It is published by Doubleday. Kevin Berry, an absolute delight to speak to you. Thank you so much for the beautiful work. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
It was a total pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me in. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, Kevin Berry's new novel is The Heart in Winter. It is published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.